The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Everybody, welcome. So first off, everyone should have received one of these zines that I made. I think there should be enough for everybody. I had a lot of fun making this. This will be the visual aid for my talk. The hope is that it'll help you follow along. I think it's very easy for a topic like this to get abstract and inaccessible. And above all, I want this to be as accessible as possible. It's in the Marxism 101 category. And this is an introductory talk. There's been a long and rich theoretical tradition surrounding ideology since Marx, but my aim here is not to go through all those strands of debate. If you want to bring those things up in discussion, that's great, but I will mainly be focusing on what Marx and Engels had to say about ideology, which while never systematically developed, like there's no ideology volume one, is still, I think, a lot more than people give them credit for. Okay, so with your zine, let's begin. Who recognizes this movie on the front? Oh, there's a lot of people. I was worried. Okay. So this is maybe the pinnacle of the 80s B movie, They Live, called by the director John Carpenter a vehicle to take on Reaganism, attributing the film's commercial failure only to the hypothesis that those who go to the movies these days in vast numbers don't want to be enlightened. Well, if you haven't seen this movie, I'll summarize it for you. And there's some images on the front cover of your zine that'll give you a sense of what this film is like. So the film follows a down-on-his-luck construction worker named John Nada, played by the magnificently mulleted pro wrestler Roddy Piper, who discovers a special pair of sunglasses. When he puts them on, he is able to see the world as it really is. He is shocked by this reality. People are being brainwashed by media. Things that look like harmless advertisements are in fact subliminal messages, such as obey, stay asleep, and submit to authority. Even more shocking, with the glasses, he is able to see that the members of the business class are in fact aliens who have taken over the world and are in charge of a massive campaign to keep humans subdued. Upon learning the truth, which he sees in simple black and white, Nada takes it upon himself to liberate humanity from its fate of alien domination. Most others won't join him. They're content. They'd rather watch TV. After a 6-minute-long alley brawl, he is able to convince one very reluctant friend to join him. Together, they kick a substantial amount of ass and make their way into the central media station. With only a hand pistol and a dying breath of fuck it, Nada is able to blow up the TV transmitter, permanently disrupting the alien's illusion and allowing all of humanity to instantly see reality. So I just spoiled the whole movie for you. If you haven't seen it, I'm sorry. But I like this movie, not only for its magnificent entertainment value, but because I think it is a well-done representation of an understanding of ideology that is very common, and one that I think is in many ways very wrong. In the world of John Nada, ideology is synonymous with illusion, simply layered on top of a black and white reality. The illusion is consciously crafted by a conspiratorial dominant class and disseminated primarily through media. Their subjects fall into two categories. Most are asleep, a few are woke. The ideology grips most of them because they don't want to face uncomfortable truths. They'd rather take comfort in consumerism or television. Fortunately, the passive and brainwashed population is able to be freed by the will and heroics of a few enlightened individuals. There are a lot of different terms you could use to describe this understanding of ideology. I'll refer to it as the magic glasses theory of ideology. And it is the aim of this talk to offer an alternative to the magic glasses theory of ideology. So I don't think all aspects of They Live depict a wrong understanding of ideology. For one, as Karl Marx famously said, the ideas of the ruling class are in every epoch the ruling ideas, i.e., the class which is the ruling material force of society is at the same time its ruling intellectual force. The class which has the means of material production at its disposal has control at the same time over the means of mental production, so that thereby, generally speaking, the ideas of those who lack the means of mental production are subject to it. This seems to fall in line pretty well with the alien-dominated world created by They Live, and undeniably the world we're familiar with, where the institutions that constitute mental production, the media, schools, universities, etc., are run by the billionaire elite. And on page 2 of your pamphlet, you can see what some of these people look like. We have billionaire Betsy DeVos running education, the Koch brothers funneling millions into libertarian think tanks, Exxon funding climate change denial research, 5 companies controlling 90% of US media, and of course, television personality extraordinaire himself, Donald Trump, as president of the United States. Sounds eerily like alien domination to me. Although, as we've seen with the recent teachers' rebellion, and the Me Too and Times Up movements, and the brave athletes taking knees against racism on ESPN, schools and the media are not simply sites of indoctrination, but also sites of resistance. It's not exactly the case that those who wish to stay asleep can do so by simply watching television. So we can already see this narrative getting complicated. But the thing I like most about this film is that it maintains a critical conception of ideology. There are a lot of different ways that people have defined and theorized ideology, and I think it's become more common to use a definition that is very neutral and very broad, synonymous with worldview or a set of ideas. Under this definition, Marxism is just one ideology among a million others, for some just the correct ideology among all the other wrong ones. There's nothing objectively wrong with this definition of ideology, and I think some theories that surround it are useful and give good contributions. This is how Lenin uses the term, for example, and I like Lenin. But I do think that this definition has the potential to be misleading for 2 main reasons. First, I don't think ideology is best understood as simply a collection of ideas. If all ideas are ideology, the object of our discussion is extremely broad, and I would say misses the special character that some particular ideas have within a class society. Even in maintaining a critical conception of ideology, I do not think ideology is best defined by whether ideas are true or false. I think ideology is best defined by the function it plays in class society. Class societies are inherently full of contradictions and antagonisms, some of which have the potential to bring the demise of that class society. The most basic antagonism is that different classes have different class interests. The function of ideology is to cover over these contradictions and obscure and/or naturalize the class relations of society. This can be accomplished with ideas that are false and ideas that are true, and in fact, there has to be some truth in an ideology in order for it to be effective. So I'll elaborate on this later, but I want to get that definition out there from the beginning. It's on page 3 of your pamphlet. Second, I think the neutral or broad concept of ideology is misleading because Marxism is best understood as a method, not a worldview necessarily. What I mean is that it's not a comprehensive lens, or shall we say a magic pair of glasses, through which we can understand all things, but a set of tools to develop and redevelop an analysis of our ever-changing world. In the same way that what we know about science is constantly changing and expanding, the scientific method remains the same. It's the core of the practice of science. I believe this is how Marx intended his theory, and there are grave consequences, as we've seen with Stalinism, when Marxism as a method of understanding is abandoned for Marxism as a set of immutable ideas. I'll outline this method briefly because it will be crucial for us to develop an understanding of ideology. Marx and Engels first begin to develop their method, which we can call historical materialism or dialectical materialism, in the German Ideology, a series of manuscripts written in response to 2 common philosophical trends in Germany at the time, idealism and mechanical materialism. And I've created a cute little Venn diagram on page 4 that you can reference. So first, against the idealists, the Marxist method is materialist, which asserts that the ideas that dominate society never develop in isolation, but are determined by the material conditions, how production is socially organized within these conditions. This is what he means when he says, it is not consciousness which determines life, but life which determines consciousness. This is the difference in saying, for example, capitalism exists because humans are greedy, or some humans are greedy because capitalism conditions them to be so. But against the mechanical materialists, Marx did not think of the word determine in a strict mechanical way. He meant more that the conditions set the stage for what ideas could develop and what could happen next. So he has room for human agency in his theory. Thank God. The material conditions limit the possible choices we can make, but our actions do shape the direction of history. This is what Marx means when he says, humans make their own history, but not in conditions of their own choosing. Another thing that keeps his theory from becoming mechanical is that life under class society that determines consciousness is full of these contradictions and antagonisms I mentioned. And because of this, material reality, and therefore consciousness, is constantly in flux. Thus, social organization under class society is never stable. When these contradictions clash, they create points of crisis, which have the potential to demolish old things and create new things. Things that seem stable just the way they are vulnerable to these crises. For Marx, this is what drives history, and this is what he means when he famously wrote in the Communist Manifesto, "The history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggle." This concept is called dialectics. Dialectics is not just an abstract or philosophical concept. It's important for our method because it gives us insight into the nature of how things change. And I think at least a few people in here want to see some things change. Okay, so now that we have our method, we'll apply it to try to make sense of some of the ideologies prevalent in our current class society, capitalism. Capitalism is a unique type of class society in which a minority ruling class, the capitalist class, owns and controls society's wealth and resources, while the vast majority of its members, the working class, are left with no other means of survival than to sell their labor to capitalists, to produce commodities sold for the capitalist profit. The workers receive some form of wage compensation to survive, but not the full value of what they produce. This is where the capitalist profit comes from. Value in a capitalist society therefore fundamentally rests on exploitation, and production is fundamentally driven by the quest for ever-increasing profits rather than human need. It is a type of class society that has incited perpetual war, produced ecological crisis on an unprecedented scale, one that is characterized by racism, sexism, homophobia, xenophobia, etc. And yet, what might we immediately think of when we think of ideology under capitalism? Shout it out. Like, people that love capitalism so much, what do they always talk about?
Freedom.
Yeah, okay. Happy belated 4th of July, freedom. Okay, but how can the ideology of freedom be so prevalent in a society as deeply oppressive and unfree as capitalism? We'll start to solve this puzzle in line with our method, with an inquiry of capitalism's historical origins, examine its relations of production, and analyze its internal contradictions. Capitalism developed in Europe only about 150 years ago from feudalism, a type of class society divided by an aristocracy in control of arable land and a peasant class that worked the land. The state took the form of a monarchy, usually closely tied to a clergy. Religion played a huge ideological role in most feudal societies, which worked to naturalize class relations with the concept of, you know, the divine right of the monarchy or whatever. Although religion still undeniably plays a role in class domination in capitalist society, it is rarely the case now that somebody's authority is primarily legitimized by way of divine right. In contrast, under capitalism, the state is presented as a rational and neutral entity. that the leaders in power got there because of their personal merit and were voted in democratically to represent the majority, regardless of whether or not this is true. It's not true. Someone with an idealist interpretation of this historical shift might say the challenge to the concept of divine right emerged because of the great thinkers, philosophers, and scientists during the Enlightenment. That because of their brilliance and rational minds, they were able to debunk the oppressive ideologies of superstition and religion. And then capitalism and liberal democracy emerged and replaced the monarchic system as a result of these ideas. But using our materialist method, we can understand the ideas of the Enlightenment did not simply emerge accidentally from the heads of certain thinkers. They were at least a partial reflection of changes taking place in the social relations of wider society. Until the emergence of capitalism, relations of production were based on relations of personal dependence, so feudal lord and vassal, landlord and serf, etc. But in order for a market economy to be established, the system of personal dependence needed to be replaced by a society in which personal freedom was dominant. This growing contradiction came to a head with the bourgeois revolutions of Europe, such as the French Revolution, that were necessary to sweep away the obstacles of the old order that were holding back the development of this new mode of production. Marx describes this historical shift in the Communist Manifesto. It's on page 6, and I will read it out loud, if only for the poetics and the drama. He says, "The bourgeoisie, wherever it has got the upper hand, has put an end to all feudal patriarchal idyllic relations. It has pitilessly torn asunder the motley feudal ties that bound man to his natural superiors, and has left remaining no other nexus between man and man than naked self-interest and callous cash payment. It has drowned the most heavenly ecstasies of religious fervor, of chivalrous enthusiasm, of Philistine sentimentalism in the icy water of egotistical calculation. The bourgeoisie has stripped of its halo every occupation hitherto honored and looked up to with reverent awe. It has converted the physician, the lawyer, the priest, the poet, the man of science into its wage laborers." Okay, so let's talk about wage labor. The wage system was a way of solving feudalism's contradictions. Namely, that as technological innovations developed, there was a limited extent to which they could be implemented because of the very static nature of these feudal relationships of personal dependence. The free wage system, where the worker was not tied to any particular piece of land or master, created a more flexible, impersonal, and calculated relationship between industry and labor. If a new technology made human labor obsolete, for example, the employer could just fire his workforce. So it was a way of solving some of these contradictions emerging within feudalism, but it was also a way of obscuring the new contradictions within capitalism. Namely, that all value in capitalism comes from exploited labor of the working class, and at the same time, the working class has the collective power to shut down all of production. So obscuring this exploitative relationship is pretty important for the ruling class. Here, Marx's concept of commodity fetishism is helpful for understanding how this exploitative relationship is successfully obscured by the wage system. So commodity fetishism, it's not as fun as it sounds, is the perception of the social relationships involved in production, not as relationships among people, but as relationships among things, money, commodities exchanged on the market. Marx observed that the value of commodities comes from the amount of labor time that went into producing them. But the act of buying and selling gets us in the habit of seeing that value as intrinsic to the object itself. So that's the fetish part. So I'm usually not at the grocery store like, oh, milk costs this much because of how much necessary labor time it took to produce this commodity. I just subconsciously think milk costs this because it does. So commodity fetishism obscures where the value comes from, i.e. human labor. Under capitalism, human labor power is also transformed into a commodity that is bought and sold on the market. The price of labor power, or the wage, appears as something intrinsic to what that labor is, the accepted compensation that we deserve for it. So in my workplace, the HR department has like some kind of software where they just put in your experience, your skills, and your education, and it just calculates what you should be making. So if I make that, and it's like generally what other people in my field make, the wage seems fair. I also have the freedom to reject that offer, to not take the job, and to not be able to buy food or pay my rent, get evicted from my apartment, if I wanted to. And therefore, in a kind of twisted way, my relationship to the wage seems free. Thus, this wage system makes exploitation appear as nothing more than free and fair exchange on the market. So here it's obvious. Ideology is not conspiracy. Your boss isn't like, mwahaha, they'll never know I'm only giving them a fraction of the value of their labor because of this wage system. Like, they believe you're getting the value of your labor. In fact, they probably believe you're getting more than you deserve for your labor. Neither is ideology simply a lie promoted through some kind of insidious propaganda campaign. Education and the media do play a significant role in deepening ideology. So the bourgeois economics were taught in school, or Paul Krugman's shitty analysis of economic phenomenon, you know, whatever. My lack of focus on this isn't to downplay that, but the point is this. The ideas disseminated through education and media could not hold water without the social praxis of, for example, participating in the exchange of commodities that constructs and verifies this ideology materially in everyday life. Okay, so we've established that the ideology of freedom, reified through liberal democracy and the wage system, was critical to the development of capitalism. But this posed a problem for the new ruling class, particularly the American ruling class, after having waged a war of independence under the banner of liberty, equality, and the inalienable rights of man, because capitalism, at its primary stage of development, what Marx calls a primitive accumulation, they needed to extract a massive amount of raw materials in order to meet the demands of mass scale industrialization, and needed access to the cheapest labor, i.e. slavery, to do it. So herein lies a contradiction. The solution to this contradiction for the ruling class was the systematic development of the ideology of race, i.e. a justification for why these inalienable rights applied to some but not others. So briefly, we'll talk about race. In the words of Barbara Fields, from her excellent essay, Slavery, Race, and Ideology in the United States of America, she says, belief in the biological reality of race outranks even astrology, the superstition closest to it in the competition for dupes among the ostensibly educated. Yet race has no biological basis. Does that mean it's not real? Is it simply illusion layered on top of the true raw reality of science? So on your pamphlet on page 7, what would John Nada see if he put on his glasses? Okay, he's looking at this very nice group of diverse people. He puts on his glasses. Okay, he sees some gray androgynous humanoid forms. Not very helpful, right? So here the magic glasses theory is not exactly helpful to get us closer to an understanding of reality. Otherwise, we have an awkward situation where your racist uncle who claims he can't see race starts to sound like the most woke person you know. Race isn't an illusion, but it's something very real. Its development was neither accidental nor conspiracy. Race isn't an idea, but an ideology that emerged from the contradictions of capitalism. It's an ideology that functions to obscure the profoundly unfree nature of this ostensibly free society. An idealist might say, Africans were enslaved because they were already seen as inferior, and that generally, oppression arises from the idea that some are inferior to others. From a materialist point of view, we can see the opposite is more the point. The material drive for cheap labor drove the search for labor overseas. The North Atlantic slave trade developed as the norm for the supply of plantation labor. Then racial ideology systematically developed over time, codified through law and custom to justify why slavery exists. Race plays a role in obscuring yet another profound contradiction within capitalism. that it is a class society where the oppressors are a tiny, tiny minority compared to the oppressed, that if united could overthrow the oppressor class. This is a problem for the ruling class. So the division of the oppressed class is very important for the maintenance of the capitalist order. This was realized by the ruling class during Bacon's Rebellion, the largest popular rebellion of colonial America, fought with an alliance between white indentured servants and Africans who, though forcefully brought to the New World, were not yet subject to full chattel slavery. So there was not that much of a difference in social status between white indentured servants and the African slave. The rebellion ended abruptly, but it shook the ruling class, who responded by hardening the racial caste of slavery in an attempt to divide the two races from subsequent united uprisings, with the passage of the Virginia Slave Codes of 1705. To quote Fields again, race does not explain this law. Rather, the law shows society in the act of inventing race. To say, as I've said, ideology isn't a conspiracy, doesn't mean it isn't ever constructed by the conscious activity of the ruling class. In the case of Bacon's Rebellion, we can see this is certainly the case. Racial ideology is not a residue from the time of slavery. It is a social reality that is actively constructed and reconstructed in an attempt to justify capitalism's injustices. Historically, this has been accomplished through segregation, disenfranchisement, racialized mass incarceration, the public hero worship of Confederate soldiers, a police force with a license to kill people of color without repercussion. These are the things that make racial difference, not an illusion, but a social reality. And we can look to countless other examples to this point. This explains, for example, why the state has been in such an honestly absurd tooth and nail fight over gender-segregated restrooms. The ideology of the gender binary is so important for the capitalist order. I don't have time to explain to you why it is. Trust me, it is. And the social praxis of having to use a gendered restroom every time you go into a public space is a social praxis that reifies the gender binary, that makes it seem so common sense to people. Giving trans people the right to use the restroom of their choice begins to weaken this ideological hold, and though not conspiracy, sections of the ruling class can feel this. This is why, even while sections of the ruling class need immigrant labor for their profit-making expenditures, borders and deportations are necessary, not only to maintain control over the flow of migration, but to reify the ideology of national chauvinism that is so essential to dividing and conquering the global working class. Attacks on reproductive rights, especially laws that punish women for reproductive choices, reify the ideology that women are not capable of being in responsible control over their own bodies. A law that, for example, limits welfare benefits to women who do not want to take birth control reifies the ideology that women's personal reproductive choices are to blame for the ills of society, such as poverty. Okay, so let's recap what we've learned so far about ideology in contrast to the magic glasses theory. We'll remember in the world of John Nada, ideology is synonymous with illusion layered on top of a black and white reality. We've seen this isn't the case. Ideology is not simply an illusion, but a reflection of real social relations. The reality is not black and white, but full of contradictions and antagonisms, and is in constant flux. In the world of John Nada, ideology is consciously crafted by a conspiratorial dominant class and disseminated primarily through media. We've seen, while at times consciously crafted, ideology is far from conspiracy. While media and propaganda do play a role in its dissemination, it has to be reified through law, custom, and social praxis in order for these things to hold water. But what about the brainwashed population in They Live? What shall we say of them? Is John Nada, the enlightened liberator, their only hope? Despite his purest intentions, he cannot be. Marx in the Communist Manifesto describes the proletarian movement, necessary for the overthrow of capitalism, as the self-conscious, independent movement of the immense majority in the interests of the immense majority. No liberator, whether individual or small group, can substitute itself for this. But given how strong the hold of bourgeois ideology that it seems to have in the immense majority, is this even possible? I'll say some brief things on this question, but I hope people elaborate on this discussion, because it's obviously important. To answer this question, the fact that ideology needs to be verified in people's daily experiences is important. Because daily experiences under capitalism are, like I've said, full of contradictions. People experience things that verify ideologies at the same time that they experience so many things that contradict them. Because the material world is contradictory, people's consciousness is going to be contradictory. It's why people often puzzlingly have progressive and reactionary ideas at the same time. This is what the Italian communist Antonio Gramsci called mixed consciousness. It is also because of this contradictory or dialectical nature of reality under class society, consciousness isn't fixed or static, but dramatically dynamic. As I've said, contradictions produce crises, and these crises are moments that disrupt ideology, moments when ideology can no longer contain or obscure these contradictions. Think of, for example, the financial crisis of 2008, how it shattered narratives about capitalism and set the stage for movements like Occupy Wall Street a few years later. Think of the election of Trump, which in many ways was a reflection of a growing crisis in the American political establishment, which disrupted narratives about the state and democracy in the United States and led so many people to feel like, for the first time, that protesting was the answer. And it is not only from the crisis itself, but from the struggle that follows, that ideology is put to the test. It is in struggle that people have new experiences in which they are forced to reckon with the question, among others, of who is on their side and who is not. Being on a multiracial picket line might, for example, challenge someone's racist ideas. Witnessing the cops try to break up that picket line might challenge someone's conception of the police. It is in struggle that some for the first time might get a sense of collective hope that disrupts the ideology that change is not possible. This doesn't mean positive change will happen because of crisis itself. That would be the mechanical materialist theory of history. In the midst of crisis, things can also shift dramatically to the right. Fascism has historically been one way capitalism has resorted to resolving its crises. Therefore, what leftists do in the midst of these crises matter. Now, because of these contradictions, consciousness is not only mixed, but it's dramatically uneven across the working class. There are some people that are more class conscious than others. This is far from an elitist claim. I don't think anyone would disagree. Some people are racist and some people are not racist. Some people like capitalism, some people do not like capitalism. Some people are willing to fight and some people are not. The role of revolutionary organization is to organize the most class-conscious and militant layer of the working class so it can collectivize its experience and knowledge and create an organizational force that is sustained through the ups and downs of crisis and calm. The role of organization, or party, is not to simply inject progressive ideas into an otherwise passive working class, but rather, when crisis hits, be ready to project an alternative to the ideologies that are starting to crumble. The strength of this alternative has a huge impact of the outcome of a crisis, which in some cases can be revolutionary periods. In this way, the party is a leader, but not a liberator. Only the entire working class can emancipate itself. The revolutionary party is rather an empowerer, which helps the masses realize the collective power that it has and empower them to take this world into their own hands. All right, so we're on the last page now. We can see John Nada, the once proclaimed liberator, is sad. The glasses aren't as useful as he thought they were upon discovery, and he is not the hero he once thought he was. To end, we'll bring it all the way back around to the film. The title of the film comes from a scene in which John Nada passes an apocalyptic graffiti which reads, "They live, we sleep." They certainly live. Lavishly with their yachts and million-dollar lofts, their ever-exorbitant profits that roll in from our exploitation. But we are anything but asleep. While ideology grips the world, it is fragile. Consciousness is dynamically shifting, and more people than we've seen in a long time are looking for alternatives and ready to fight back. There's a great opening for us to contend for hegemony in the battle over ideas and for the fate of this world, and this should give us a lot of hope. Thanks. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.